Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading this week's articles from the San Angelo Standard Times newspaper for the week of Sunday, July 17th, 2022. Due to the fact that there are never an hour's worth of local news articles anymore, I'll be reading a mix of local and state articles, sports articles, and a couple of feature columns. North Angelo Branch Library Closes for Renovations, by Rosanna Frere, published July 21st. The North Angelo Branch Library is expected to be closed for 6 to 9 months for a much-needed renovation, according to a news release. For the past year, the Tom Green County Library System has been making plans and raising funds for the renovation of the 47-year-old library at 3001 North Chadburn Street. The library closed its doors and work began July 18th. We're excited to embark on the construction phase of the North Branch Expansion Project, made possible through community and county support, Library Director Jill Donegan said. We're grateful to the Tom Green County Friends of the Library, the Library Advisory Board, and a number of local foundations for recognizing the need for this project and pledging their support. While key fundraising goals have been met, we are still seeking donations to top off the project. We regret the extended closure, but know that this disruption in operations will be well worth it as we upgrade the facility. In the meantime, patrons can visit the Stevens Central Library downtown at 33 West Beauregard Avenue or Angelo West Branch Library at 3013 Vista del Arroyo. For more information, call the Tom Green County Library System at 325-655-7321. And now the state article published on the front page of the Standard Times, Thursday, July 21st. Has Uvalde Police Response Debunked the Good Guy with a Gun Narrative? By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times. The 376 armed and trained law enforcement officers from local, state, and federal agencies took well over an hour to confront and kill the murderer of 19 children and two teachers in Uvalde, provided a wide opening for advocates of further gun restrictions to debunk the claim that more guns are the answer to stopping mass shootings. However, just moments after the committee of the Texas House on Sunday finished publicly explaining its report that pointed out failure after failure by those officers at Robb Elementary School on May 24th, an armed and far less trained bystander, 1,258 miles away in Greenwood, Indiana, shot and killed a gunman who had already killed people at a shopping mall and would have likely tried to kill even more. Elisha Dickin, the man who killed the Indiana mall shooter, was called heroic and prompted political leaders, Second Amendment defenders, and ordinary Americans to once again invoke the words of National Rifle Association President Wayne LaPierre in the days following the December 14, 2012 mass shooting that left 26 dead at Connecticut's Sandy Hook Elementary School. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. The competing narratives from the two incidents, 54 days and 1,258 miles apart, will likely do little to bridge the yawning divide that separates the most vocal proponents of gun rights and the activists who want more restrictions on who may own firearms and the types of firearms that remain commercially available. But some on both sides of what has emerged as one of the most polarizing issues in contemporary politics acknowledge that the good guy argument is too complex and nuanced to be used as a rubber stamp solution to gun violence. I think, frankly, both sides are inclined to use cliches or bumper stickers, said former Texas Land Commissioner Jerry Patterson, who, as a Republican state senator in the mid-1990s, was the driving force behind the first law that allowed law-abiding Texans to publicly carry concealed handguns. There is something called a good guy with a gun, he added, and of course there are problems associated with it. The problem we have is that there's a lot of good guys with guns who probably aren't very proficient in their use of a firearm. Perhaps a well-trained armed teacher inside Robb Elementary might have been able to act as Dickon did at the Indiana Mall, Patterson said, and that might have given the hesitating law enforcement officers time to act more quickly. However, a 2021 FBI study showed that there's been only about 25 incidents since 2014 where civilians with concealed handgun permits were able to step in and stop an active shooter. Nicole Golden, the executive director of Texas Gun Sense, which lobbies for additional limits on firearm availability, said the statistic is a sobering reminder that would-be victims cannot count on random strangers carrying guns to save them from tragedy. Our leaders at every level of government are responsible for our public safety, Golden said, and an important element of that is ensuring that dangerous weapons do not end up in the hands of dangerous individuals. Stephen Williford, the NRA member who famously opened fire on the shooter who killed 25 people, including a woman whose unborn child died, at the First Baptist Church at Sutherland Springs on November 5, 2017, strenuously disagreed. He said the inaction by law enforcement at Robb Elementary and the swift action by the Indiana civilian underscore his argument. Uvalde proves that you are your own first responder and that you need to be armed and you need to be ready because police don't necessarily come to save you, said Williford, who uses his unwanted fame to advocate for gun rights. We need to do away with gun-free zones altogether. The guy in Indiana was in a gun-free zone, he added. Because he ignored the rules, he was able to stop a mass shooter who was loaded for bear and ready to kill lots of people. This 22-year-old young man was able to take him out. Jacqueline Schildkraut, a criminal justice professor at State University of New York at Oswego, who co-authored a 2022 study for Texas State's Alert Center that examined the advisability of arming teachers, said she's skeptical that most civilians, even if they've taken firearm training, can be counted on to keep cool under such stress. There's a difference between shooting at a paper target that's not moving and completely stationary in front of you and is X number of yards away, and then actually firing during a tactical response, Schildkraut said. Armed civilians who draw weapons can also pose a danger to themselves, she added. If you're a police officer, you walk into a room and you see two people with a gun and you have a split second to make a decision of who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, before you drop one of them, Schildkraut said. How do you know you're going to get that right? Patterson, who left public office in 2015, said the more likely scenario would be, as in the Indiana Mall case, that an armed civilian who acts limits the opportunity for further bloodshed. A citizen doesn't have to shoot the threat dead, Patterson said. The mere presence of resistance, maybe even gunfire, immediately changes the dynamic. Number one, the shooter has to pay attention to the person that's shooting at them now instead of killing other people. In terms of practical politics, University of Houston political science major Brandon Rottinghouse said, the police response in Uvalde is likely to tarnish the good guy slogan that has cemented itself into the gun rights debate ever since LaPierre invoked it after Sandy Hook. Some political figures will no doubt continue to use it, Rottinghouse said, but its salience among mainstream voters may have diminished since Uvalde. It's politically powerful to suggest that arming citizens can be an effective deterrence to mass shootings, he said. But realistically, that notion just doesn't hold up. It's only a political crutch. Here are three articles published on the front page of the San Angelo Standard-Times, Wednesday, July 20th. Uvalde officers ignored shooter response plan. This is going to set back law enforcement 20 years. By Lindsay Whitehurst, Associated Press. A total of 376 officers converged on Robb Elementary School, more than the entire police force in a mid-sized American city like Fort Lauderdale, Florida, or Tempe, Arizona. But for more than 70 minutes, not one stopped the shooter. Amid the sounds of continuing gunfire emanating from the elementary school, they waited. By the time they entered and killed 18-year-old Salvador Ramos, 19 children and two teachers were dead or mortally wounded. The response counters active shooting training that emphasizes confronting the gunman, a standard established more than two decades ago after the mass shooting at Columbine High School showed that waiting costs lives. "This is going to set back law enforcement 20 years. It really will," said Greg Schaefer, a retired FBI agent who is now a Dallas-based security consultant. "It was a calamity of errors." It's not clear how many more people at Robb Elementary were shot while police waited, but the delay also meant more time before the wounded could get potentially life-saving care, he said, following the Sunday release of a damning report from an investigative committee from the Texas House of Representatives that detailed the chaotic response. "You have to assume that people are in critical need of medical attention," he said. "The terminology that we use when we train is, you have to stop the killing before you can stop the dying." That was a tragic lesson from the 2016 mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, where more than half the people killed bled to death before they could get emergency care, he said. From the beginning, the officers' tactics in Uvalde didn't match with most standard operating procedure, Schaefer said. Rather than advance together, one of the three officers lagged behind the others and another halted, and among those early responders, two had long guns and a third had a handgun, which could have had enough gunpower to confront the intruder quickly. "Those are great odds. I'll take those odds any day of the week," Schaefer said. As more officers arrived on scene, rather than acting as one overwhelming force to take down the shooter, they seemed to have little cohesion or leadership, said Maria Haverfield, a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. That's largely because they were from multiple overlapping agencies who didn't communicate effectively with each other, something she worries could happen again. "You have a number of departments that do not work together on a regular basis, responding to a crisis situation. It's chaotic, it's unprofessional, it's dysfunctional," she said. "It's just the best illustration of the worst case scenario that I've been practicing for years now, that this multiplication of agencies is going to lead to disaster." Criminal charges against officers could be possible, but civil liability is more likely, Schaefer said. A handful of local officers have been placed on leave, including the acting Uvalde police chief and the school district police chief, but the overwhelming majority of the officers who responded were federal and state law enforcement. That included nearly 150 U.S. Border Patrol agents and 91 state patrol officials. "I think that's a lot of people. I think that a lot of people need to lose their job," Schaefer said. Altogether, the Sunday report and more than 3 hours of newly released body camera footage from the May 24th tragedy amounted to the fullest account to date of one of the worst school shootings in U.S. history. Some families blasted police as cowards and demanded resignations. Frank Straub, director of the National Policing Institute's Center for Targeted Violence Prevention, said the chaos surrounding who was the incident commander at the scene is one thing that departments that work together normally practice. While the situation created confusion, the basic point that was missed was still getting to the shooter as quickly as possible. "The obligation is to neutralize the shooter. Stop the shooting, stop the bleeding. That's the sequence," said Straub, a former police chief. As protective equipment arrived on scene, ballistic vests, ballistic helmets, by protocol, they should have kept going. It was their obligation to stop the shooting. Even during the lulls in the shooting, there had to be the realization that there were students and teachers in those classrooms, and if they were going to survive, they needed immediate medical attention, he said. Why Abbott and O'Rourke are not seeking help from Trump or Biden. Austin. The top political advisors to Republican Greg Abbott were almost gleeful when they explained how they planned to join the hip Democrat Beto O'Rourke and President Joe Biden as the race for governor heads towards the fall. After all, Biden's approval rating in Texas is deep underwater amid soaring inflation and a stubborn COVID-19 virus that seems to spawn newer and faster spreading variants almost by the week. But when the question came up in telephone roundtable with reporters on Wednesday on whether Abbott would be inviting former President Donald Trump to join in on him in on the campaign trail in what so far is shaping up as a tight race with the former congressman from El Paso, the response from the governor's camp went something like, "Who?" That's probably an exaggeration, but not much of one. "It's never been discussed," said Chief Strategist Dave Carney. We tend not to do a lot of outside the endorsements in the general election because we're narrow casting, because less than 10% of the voters. They, the Trump camp, haven't offered. We haven't discussed it. I've never heard anybody on our team speculate about it. At first blush, the response sounds counterintuitive. When Trump was president, he summoned Abbott to the White House to hail his approach to the pandemic, particularly the governor's eagerness to lift the stay-at-home orders and jumpstart the state's economy. After the presidency, Abbott hosted Trump for something of a pep rally at the Texas border to contrast the Republicans' approach to immigration with that of his successor. A chummy relationship. And as recently as January, Abbott joined Trump at his rally in the suburban community of Conroe, north of Houston. There, even though he was greeted by a smattering of boos, Abbott lavished praise on the former president, who's been known to feed off it. Donald J. Trump loves the great state of Texas, and Texans love President Donald J. Trump, Abbott thundered at the event that occurred 1 year and 9 days after Trump became an ex-president. But more recent developments indicate that any level of love Texans might feel for Trump has taken a bit of a nosedive, which could explain Carney's tepid response regarding a Trump-Abbott campaign trail reunion. Polling since the hearings of the U.S. House Committee began in June to examine the events that spawned the June 6, 2021 insurrection at the nation's capital, the influence the outgoing president exerted on them, shows Trump's disapproval and rating in Texas rising to 50% or more. Biden's own favorability ratings are down to an anemic 35%. And that clearly explains why Abbott and company want to hang the president around the neck of O'Rourke, and why O'Rourke, ever since he entered the governor's race late last year, has kept his distance from the leader of his party. Narrowcasting to voters. Trump's numbers help explain the narrowcasting part of Carney's response to the question about the governor's apparent reluctance to be seen as too chummy with the de facto leader of his party, heading toward the home stretch in his bid for a third term. The same polling, exposing Texas's antipathy for Biden and Trump, show O'Rourke and Abbott within 5 to 7 percentage points of each other. That's pretty close to the margin of error. And even more recently, Friday to be exact, campaign finance reports showed O'Rourke outraising the incumbent by a couple of million dollars since February. Each candidate has pretty much a lock on his party's base. That's why Abbott, and for that matter, O'Rourke, have to narrowcast to the 10% or so who haven't made up their minds. And that's also why national figures who play only to the base of either party might do more harm than help, as voters who swing back and forth between the red side and the blue side try to figure out where they want to land on November 8th. Article by John C. Moritz, who covers Texas government and politics for the USA Today Network in Austin. State Bar argues Paxton voter fraud allegations. It says he should have known claims false. By Chuck Liddell, Austin American Statesman. Defending its lawsuit against State Attorney General Ken Paxton of unethical and dishonest conduct, a State Bar of Texas disciplinary committee said Paxton knew or should have known that his claims of widespread voting fraud in the 2020 presidential election were false, misleading, and unsupported by credible evidence. The State Bar's Commission for Lawyer Discipline has asked a state judge to reprimand Paxton for pressing the U.S. Supreme Court to set aside Democrat Joe Biden's election victories in 4 swing states. One element of a widespread but unsuccessful campaign by supporters of then-President Donald Trump to overturn Biden's victory in the Electoral College and hand the Republican a second term in office. Paxton told the Supreme Court that Texas had amassed substantial evidence of election fraud and other improprieties, enough to propel Biden to victory in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, and Wisconsin. That claim, the bar committee argued, was a lie based on unconfirmed allegations, as well as information that had been debunked and refuted well before Paxton sought intervention from the Supreme Court on December 7th, 2020, a month after the election that Trump refused to concede and actively tried to overturn. Moreover, to this day, no evidence exists to show that an outcome determinative number of improperly cast votes were ever counted, or that anyone engaged in the false illegal acts that he alleged in his pleadings, the committee told State District Judge Casey Blair of Kaufman County, who was assigned to hear its complaint against Paxton. If the commission prevails in its case, Paxton, who is seeking a third term in November, could receive a public reprimand, have his law license suspended, or be disbarred, making him unable to practice law in Texas. The state attorney general is not required to be a practicing lawyer. In the end, the Supreme Court rejected the complainant, known as Texas versus Pennsylvania, which claimed the election results were skewed by improper pandemic-related changes to voting procedures in the four states, within 4 days, ruling that Texas lacked standing to challenge election processes in other states. The bar committee's arguments, contained in a legal brief filed with Blair on Thursday night, were in response to Paxton's motion to dismiss the lawsuit as an unconstitutional check on his power and a politically motivated attack based on his support for Trump. Paxton also argued that the attorney general can't be sued for exercising his discretionary power to represent Texas in court. In addition, Paxton told the judge that the lawsuit violates the Texas Constitution's separation of powers doctrine by allowing the state bar, an agent of the judicial branch, to interfere with the attorney general, a member of the executive branch, to impose such sanctions on the attorney general, indeed to further subject the attorney general to the burden, cost, and indignity of this proceeding, would unduly interfere with the executive branch's effectual exercise of its constitutionally assigned powers, Paxton argued in the motion filed late in June. Do ethical standards apply to Paxton? In its response, the Commission for Lawyer Discipline said Paxton was under the mistaken notion that the state's ethical standards for lawyers don't apply to him, even when he was acting as the state's lead attorney in a case before the Supreme Court. State law is clear, the commission said. Every attorney admitted to practice law in Texas must follow established ethical standards, including the one the commission accused Paxton of violating. A lawyer shall not engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. While the role of Texas Attorney General may be unique, Paxton's ethical responsibilities as an attorney while actively engaged in the practice of law in the Pennsylvania case are no different than those of every other Texas-licensed attorney, the commission wrote. The commission also disagreed with Paxton's claim that he, as an elected official, is immune from its lawsuit. Sovereign immunity can apply if lawsuits seek to control actions taken on behalf of the government, but the commission said its lawsuit was not about Paxton's decision to attack the election results in the four states. Instead, the agency alleged that Paxton made dishonest statements and representations in his Supreme Court pleadings. Allegations of dishonesty. The commission also listed in greater detail than in its original lawsuit its allegations of dishonesty by Paxton, including claiming the four states committed or permitted multiple illegal or unconstitutional acts, such as illegally backdating, accepting, or harvesting mail-in ballots with no supporting evidence. Claiming again with no proof that evidence of material illegality in the 2020 general elections held in defendant states grows daily. Instead, the commission noted then U.S. Attorney General William Barr had explained 6 days earlier that the Justice Department had uncovered no evidence of widespread voter fraud that could change the outcome of the 2020 election. Claiming that 174,384 absentee ballots were counted in Detroit from voters who did not supply proof of voter registration, when Michigan elections officials had already determined that only 150 of those ballots had not been verified before being counted. Claiming that Pennsylvania reported sending out 3.1 million mail-in ballots when other data put the actual number at 2.7 million, a discrepancy of 400,000 ballots. Instead, the commission said, state officials had established that the 3.1 million number was accurate. Claiming that a glitch in Dominion voting machines caused 6,000 Trump votes in Michigan to be improperly switched to Biden. Instead, the commission said it was known that no votes were switched and that any tabulation error was a result of human error corrected that same day. Claiming that the number of absentee and mail-in ballots that were handled unconstitutionally exceeded Biden's margin of victory in the four states. To date, no evidence exists to support this statement, and none existed at the time Paxton filed these false and dishonest allegations in his pleadings with the court, the commission said. The facts support a court judgment of professional misconduct against Paxton, the commission concluded. As an attorney who is also a public official, Paxton holds a position of public trust and, at a minimum, should be held to at least the same disciplinary standards as all other Texas licensed attorneys in the practice of law, it said. TSHL already at work for 2023 state legislative session. By Dr. Sherry Hubbard, special to the Standard Times, published July 15th. During the Texas Silver-Haired Legislature's 2022 legislative session, held in Austin the first week of May, 71 resolutions, recommendations, were proposed, and after committee reviews and the final vote, 54 were approved for the TSHL legislative report to the Texas State Legislature for its 2023 session. Our members have already begun the advocacy process for the upcoming state legislative session beginning January 2023 through phone calls, emails, written testimony, and presence at legislative committee meetings in Austin. It is critical that we get consideration of our recommendations started so that they can have the potential to become part of the state priorities in the lawmaking process. And we are beginning the scheduling of meetings with each legislator or their staff for early September. All 54 resolutions passed by the TSHL are important, but we also identified the top 10 priority resolutions impacting older Texans as listed below with their ranking number and resolution number. Top 10 priority TSHL resolutions. Number 1, R003. Increase the personal needs allowance for Medicaid residents in nursing homes. Number 2, R041. Child-related income follows the child. Kinship custodial placements. Number 3, R046. Increase the readability of the application and vote-by-mail documentation to reduce the rejection rate. Number 4, R024. Authorize TRS to provide a cost of living adjustment to teacher retirement system retirees. Number 5, R001. Require a criminal background check for CNAs and LVNs in nursing homes and home health companies. Number 6, R022. Authorize a 13th month annuity payment to employees retirement system, ERS, retirees. Number 7, R042. Amend family code to provide for a grandparent conservatorship and support bill. Number 8, R037. Improve access to health care in rural Texas for older Texans. Number 9, R008. Establish full practice authority, FPA, for advanced practice registered nurses, APRNs. Number 10, R009. Increase the maximum rate of home-delivered meals for older Texans to $10 with an annual cost of living adjustment. All the resolutions can be viewed on the TSHL.org website under Legislative Report. The TSHL resolutions cover a number of key areas of senior concern: financial security, rural health care, nursing care, nutrition, and prevention of elder abuse. Also, our members address two additional but critical areas: the grandparent raising grandchildren issues, see number 2 and number 7, and promoting older Texans' participation in the election process through a more effective mail-in ballot, see number 3. More recently, on July 11th, Representative Drew Darby swore in our latest TSHL representative, Linda Cahill from San Angelo, by way of Sonora. We're delighted to have Linda join our ranks as we work hard on behalf of older Texans. This final year in our current two-year term in TSHL will be spent advocating for these resolutions to be adopted, passed, and signed into law by the governor. The Concho Valley is well represented by the following: Wayne Merrill of San Angelo, TSHL Comptroller; Dr. Sharon Kulig and Linda Cahill of San Angelo; Cindy Jones of Mason and Bridget Rogers of Sonora, along with Dr. Sherry Hubbard of Junction. The TSHL representatives serve under the auspices of the Concho Valley Area Agency on Aging and the Council of Governments. Dr. Sherry Hubbard is a Kimball County resident and a Concho Valley representative to the TSHL, serving her fourth two-year term. She is the current TSHL Speaker Pro Tem. Contact Sherry, Sherry, Hub, Hubb, the numeral 1, at yahoo.com. Website, www.tshl.org. And now here are a few sports articles. Former Wall pitcher Luke Young selected by Washington Nationals in MLB draft, by Charles Bryce, published July 19th. Former Wall High School and Midland College pitcher Luke Young was selected as the 321st pick by the Washington Nationals in the 11th round of the 2022 Major League Baseball draft Tuesday. "Oh, it's an amazing feeling," Young said. "I've been thinking about it since I was a little kid. The Nationals just kind of called and told me it was kind of between me and three other guys. And I got the call a little bit later, and they told me they decided that it was going to be me. I'm just filled with joy. It was difficult going to sleep every night in case anything happened." The 6'3", 170-pounder signed a Division I deal with Oklahoma State University this past November, but he says he'll take the option of turning pro instead. Young is coming off a great sophomore season at Midland College. He finished with a 9-4 record and an ERA of 3.95. In 79.2 innings, he chalked up 110 strikeouts, more than twice as many Ks as he had in his first season with the Chaparrals. "I think it was just a huge mental thing on the mound and getting really confident up there," he said. "That 1 year under my belt helped a lot. And then going up to the Northwoods that year, playing in Minnesota for the Mankato Moondogs during the summer, I felt coming into my sophomore year at Midland, I had a lot of control and a lot of confidence up there on the mound." The hard-throwing righty capped off his senior season at Wall by helping the Hawks win the UIL Class 3A Baseball State Championship in 2019. That's the first state championship in program history, and Young was named the UIL Class 3A Most Valuable Player. When Young was in high school, Hawks head coach Jason Schneiders said he was throwing in the 84 to 86 mile per hour range. The 20-year-old is now throwing 96 miles per hour after putting on some weight and muscle during his two seasons of junior college ball. "I think if he continues to put a little more weight on, he may be a kid who's able to throw 100 miles per hour one of these days," Schneiders said back in November, and that's pretty exciting to think about. Robert Verdon, who has coached at the high school and collegiate level and was a major league scout for the Cincinnati Reds from 1987 to 1990, coached Young in American Legion baseball in 2018 and 2019. Verdon predicted that Young would get drafted by an MLB team, and now that's become a reality. "Luke is the best player that I've ever coached," Verdon said last fall. "I think he's going to a higher level than anybody I've ever coached. Out of probably 40 years of coaching, he's probably the best one. He's on level to be a top major league player. There's a lot of steps between here and there and getting there, and some luck involved in staying healthy. But the talent level is equal to the best in the country, the best in the world." Young is the son of Jeff Young and Terry Young. His father played for San Angelo Lakeview High School and Ranger Junior College. Young's nephew, Corbin Odell, played on Wall's Little League All-Star team earlier this summer. The MLB signee says his family has been very supportive over the years, helping him realize his dream. "They've been amazing," Young said. "Everything they've done and everything they've given me the opportunity to do, it's all been amazing." "Growing up, it was the thing in my family to play baseball, and you either got good at it or you still played it anyways. It's just a fun thing in the family to do." Bulls of the West Make a Triumphant Return to the Spur Arena by Charles Bryce, published July 17th. 18-year-old Cy Ferguson stole the show at the Bulls of the West freestyle bullfighting event Saturday night in front of an appreciative audience at the First Community Federal Credit Union Spur Arena. 12 competitors from around the world showcased their skills of dodging and juking some of the best Mexican fighting bulls provided by Troy and Lindsey Bradshaw with Penthouse Fighting Bulls, and the top four advanced to the short go. Ferguson earned a score of 88 in the finals to pick up the first place prize. "This is my first win," said Ferguson, a teenager from Boyd, who has competed in about a half dozen of these events in his young career. The competitors were rooting each other on during the three-hour event, and all 12 of them were lined up for a meet-and-greet with fans afterwards. "It's like a brotherhood," the 18-year-old Texan said. "It's fun to be around. They congratulate you, and there's a dog pile at the end. It's just something that you don't get to feel all the time." San Angelo is known for having some of the best knowledgeable rodeo fans in the country, and West Texans have really embraced this freestyle bullfighting event as well. "Oh man, the energy's great," Ferguson said. "It really fuels the fight and sets the tone for everything. It's real fun, and they make it good. I came out, and they gave me that extra boost of energy to end on a good note tonight." He didn't initially know how big of a paycheck that he earned, but it will be a sizable one, and he plans to save the money. Ferguson is following in family footsteps. "My dad used to bullfight, and I kind of grew up in his shadow," the 18-year-old said. He started getting me on this, and that's where I'm at." Like bull riders in regular rodeo events, most people think you have to be a little crazy to do something that's so dangerous as bullfighting. That's not always the case, however. "I've actually had a couple buddies join me," Ferguson said. "They're starting to get into it because I got into it. I have a few travel buddies, and we just have a good time while we're doing it." Scoring-wise, half of the points come from the bullfighter, and the other half comes from the bulls themselves. "It's different than Spanish-style bullfighting and is more like what rodeo fans see with rodeo clowns." After the first 40 seconds of bullfighting, competitors had the option of either stopping at that point and earning whatever score the judges award them, or going an extra 30 seconds to try to increase their score. The bullfighters also have the option of bringing out the barrel man, as they use the barrel to entice the bovines to get even more ornery. One of the bulls was extremely ornery, and it took more than half an hour to get him out of the arena. Spectators at the VIP tables up close to the arena were told to scoot back a little to avoid danger. In addition to Ferguson, the three other finalists included Jason Martin of Weatherford, Austin Ashley of Purcell, Oklahoma, and Tucker McWilliams of Oak Grove, Missouri. Event coordinator Jill Sisk and her family from Sterling City have been putting on this event since 2014. Her father, Bill Halfman, and her husband, Casey Sisk, have helped make this an annual tradition, along with her brother, Jason Hoffman, and his wife, Taylor Hoffman. After the first four rounds were completed, Jill Sisk and Taylor Hoffman presented Kermit Wendland with an honorary gift for his dedication over the years. Wendland has been involved with this event since its inception, and he's helped out with the San Angelo Stock Show and Rodeo since 1971. This was the seventh year for the Bulls of the West to come to San Angelo, and the last time they had it was in 2019. Due to COVID, the event was put on hiatus in 2020 and 2021. It gets bigger every year, Jill Six said. It was a phenomenal turnout. We had probably at least 500 people at the VIP tables around the arena, so it was just awesome. We really enjoy it. We have sold more tables on the VIP than we ever have because we added more seats. We're growing every year in the stands, we can tell. Sisk estimated that just under 1,000 people were in attendance. If you weren't able to make it this year, Sisk highly encourages fans to give this event a try in 2023. Get your ticket and get your VIP table if you want it, Sisk said. It's obviously an adrenaline rush, and you can't beat this. If you like to live life on the edge, this is your thing, and we love having it. UIL and THSCA waiting on state legislature regarding NIL changes by Quentin Martinez, Corpus Christi Times, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, July 17th, San Antonio. Name, image, and likeness rules have resulted in rapid changes to the NCAA landscape in the short time since they have been enacted. Though there is a likelihood it may be discussed during next year's session of the Texas legislature, neither the UIL nor the Texas High School Coaches Association anticipates NIL rules to be adopted for high school athletes in the near future, based on comments made Sunday at THSCA Coaching School at the Henry B. Gonzalez Convention Center in San Antonio. Texas does not allow high school athletes to engage in NIL contracts, UIL Deputy Director Janie Harrison said during a media availability. That is not at the UIL authority level. That is at the state legislative level. Until there is movement there, there will be no change from UIL. Even if there were movement, we'd have to see what way it moves. Joe Martin, the president of the THSCA, said that there are between 17 and 19 states that currently allow their high school athletes to profit from their name, image, and likeness, and the association is not promoting a change to allow the same in Texas. What the THSCA is providing is education for coaches and administrators on what NIL is and what laws are in various states, in order to help athletes that may be high-profile Division I recruits. The association has partnered with the Ecker Group, which had a booth at the convention this week. Those schools that have high-profile athletes that are being recruited, those coaches and those kids need to know what the laws are and what the rules are, whether you're just being recruited in the state of Texas or you have someone recruited in California, Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, because all those laws are different, Martin said. Our coaches have to be educated enough to get information to those kids so they can make a proper decision. We are engaged in the Ecker Group in promoting them to help educate our coaches. Harrison said, until the state legislature were to make any movement on allowing NIL at the high school level, the UIL would not make any moves regarding any rules or regulation. Although there is a small amount of concern that athletes at Texas public schools and border communities may consider moving into a neighboring state to make money through NIL deals, the other side of the coin is that if it were allowed in Texas, that athletes may transfer within the state for the same purpose. If a player were going to leave a Texas high school to go play in another state to go make NIL money, if we allowed it in Texas, why would it be any different than that kid leaving that high school to go to another Texas high school to make NIL money? Harrison said. You get into the haves and have-nots about who has the community that can throw the most money out there to attract the best players from across the state to come be on that team. I don't know that our schools want that, or quite frankly, Texas wants that. Harrison said, the UIL is interested in seeing how NIL rules mature, both at the college level and in those states that allow it for high schoolers before rushing to decisions. Newsworthy. Harrison said the UIL said adding a Class 7A is always discussed, but is currently a math problem. The league would need roughly 600 schools to break up the top three classifications into equitable pieces and that would dip the bottom end of Class 5A into a range between 1,100 and 1,300 students, making a move currently unreasonable. Class 5A and 6A currently house roughly 500 schools. Harrison said the state football championships will return to AT&T Stadium in Arlington this season, and there is no push to move the state basketball tournament back to Austin from its current venue at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio. There is no groundswell of support for the split division concept in football to be adopted in Class 6A, and it is firm in Class 4A and below. But due to opt-outs in Class 5A, there is talk of finding guardrails for the opt-up process to ensure the purpose of having split divisions is not lost due to large numbers of schools choosing to move to Division 1 and artificially moving the line. We are trying to fine-tune those knobs where we keep them as equal in terms of total number of schools in Division 1 and Division 2 as we can, but we can't keep it equal and still have the whole point of having a split conference, which is to help to reduce the enrollment disparity from top to bottom, Harrison said. We still have a lot to work out in 5A Division 1 and Division 2. There is a lot of conversations around putting some guardrails around who can opt in and how many can opt up, because it is really the opt-ups that impact the overall final product. Favorites coast to victory in TSMCA All-Star Basketball Games by Corey Hoag, special to the Wichita Falls Times Record News, published in the San Angelo Standard Times July 17th. It was a banner day for the West in the Texas Six-Man Coaches Association Basketball All-Star Games on Saturday afternoon inside Ryder Fieldhouse in Wichita Falls. Girls Basketball, West 74, East 32. The West All-Stars were heavy favorites entering the girls' game for a good reason. All five starters from the West were All-State selections. The East is also filled with All-Stars, and we knew they were coming to compete and go after us hard today, West coach Ben Connell said. We may have been favored to win, but our kids were still nervous, and some of them hadn't picked up a basketball in a while until this week, so we had to knock the rust off a little bit. It was a fitting send-off for the West duo of Landry Morrow and Liliana Porras of Sands, who were able to play for their coach one last time before heading to college. I'm not usually big into coaching all-star games, but I wanted to coach this game because of Liliana and Landry, and to have one more chance to coach and be around them, Connell said. They've been with me for 7 years, and they're the reason we won the state championship, and it was an awesome experience to do it one last time. Morrow, who will soon continue her basketball career at Angelo State, was named Defensive Player of the Game while finishing tied with her high school teammate, Porras, and Shaylin Weathers of White Deer with 9 points. Robert Lee standout Braylee Hood took home Offensive Player of the Game honors after leading all scorers with 12 points. The East was led by Chloe Taylor, who scored 7 points. It's been a journey, and I'm grateful to have earned the Defensive Player of the Game in my final game as a high school player, Morrow said. I wasn't sure I was going to play, but when I found out Connell was our coach, I knew I had to play with him one last time. What was fun about this game was having a bunch of all-stars and being able to put any of them in the game at any time without having to worry. All 14 of them were capable of doing anything we asked them to do, Connell said. Boys basketball. West 104, East 53. In the boys game, the West ran out to a big lead early before cruising to victory. The West led the East 29-8 after the first quarter and never scored fewer than 23 points in any quarter. The West was incredible from three-point range in the contest, hitting 17 shots from long distance, led by Offensive Player of the Game, Evan DeLeon of Spring Lake Earth, who hit 6 three-pointers. In total, 8 players from the West hit a three-point shot in the contest. It was this way all week in practice, Whiteface coach Todd Sessom said of his West squad. I tried to get them to run a set offense, but they love the three, so they were just going to shoot the ball. The East equaled its first half points, 17, in the third quarter, while the West struggled to begin the second half until De Leon caught fire beyond the arc. Four of De Leon's 6 3-pointers came in the second half, with his only tray in the third quarter sparking the West to another big run. I don't know how to describe the feeling, but it feels like muscle memory, De Leon said. When that first one went in, I felt like I wasn't going to miss again. The first day of practice was a little sketchy, but we got to know each other and developed amazing chemistry, which helped us on the court. Everyone was able to score in our scrimmages, so we weren't surprised we were able to score over 100 points today. Basketball runs through him, and he loves to play the game, Sessom said of De Leon. This group is so talented, and all 14 do things well. It made coaching this game easy. Julius Stevenson of Trinidad led the East with 18 points, while his teammate from Wetherall, Aiden Van Zant, joined him in double figures with 11 points. De Leon led the West with 24 points. Defensive player of the game, Steven Arizmendez of Klondike, added 16 points, while Cooper McCleskey from Guthrie scored 12 points. And Matthew Pena of Buena Vista rounded out the West players in double figures with 10 points. The whole week we had a great time, Arizmendez said. I grew up playing against a lot of these guys, and it's fun that we were able to come together in this game. I've never earned an award like this, and I didn't expect to have such a good game, but I was able to take advantage of my opportunity today. Six-man football. West nips East in TSMCA Division I All-Star Game. By Jonathan Hull, Wichita Falls Times Record News, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, July 16th. Iowa Park. The East All-Stars held the lead in both halves of the Texas Six-Man Coaches Association Division I Football All-Star Game on Friday night. However, the West All-Stars had an answer each time in a 36-26 victory. It was a great game, and it was back and forth, Sterling City coach Trey Sisco said after leading the West to the victory. Often an All-Star game is a blowout, but this was close to the end and a lot of fun. The East jumped to a fast start when Nat Hilliker intercepted a pass on the West's first play from scrimmage. The first play for the East was far more successful, with Cannon Wise finding Gabriel Pacheco for a 62-yard touchdown. The West's next offensive play from scrimmage turned into another disaster when Gavin Lee of Covington recovered a fumbled snap to give the East the ball at the West's 24-yard line. However, the West defense stood tall and forced the East to turn the ball over on downs before reeling off the next 22 points in the game. To come back from turning the ball over on our first two series and to be able to come back from that was amazing, Sisco said. I coach the defense and try to instill the mindset that we can stop teams in those situations. The East scored 20 unanswered points to take a 26-22 lead heading into the fourth quarter. But once again, the West fought back, scoring the final 14 points of the contest, capped by Jackson Edwards' 8-yard run with 107 left in regulation. We were hurting ourselves in the third quarter, so we had to keep our head in the game, get everything straightened out, execute the play, and come together with the game on the line, Edwards said. I felt like we were underdogs coming into tonight, St. Joe coach Mark Stevens said about his East squad. The West has been really good in this game, and we talked about how to give ourselves a chance to win was to play together as a team. I thought we did that during the first three quarters, but the West made some good plays in the fourth quarter. Edwards earned Offensive Player of the Game after accounting for 178 of the West's 369 total yards. Edwards was most dangerous as a receiver, catching 5 passes for 123 yards. Jonesboro's Ian Schoaf took home Defensive Player of the Game honors for the East. He can do anything, Sisco said. He's one of the best route runners I've ever seen, and I'm sure he hasn't done much of that because He's always been the stud in the backfield. He's like a Swiss Army knife. Hermley's Bubba Digby provided a spark for the West throughout the contest, gaining 95 yards and scoring 2 touchdowns on 9 attempts. Digby's 42-yard run put the West ahead with 6:56 left in the fourth quarter. I had a lot of fun playing with guys that I never really knew before this week, Bubba Digby said. Jackson Edwards, Jermaine Gorales, Jimmy Roberts. It was a complete team effort tonight. And now here's a feature column. Chardonnay has experienced ups and downs in recent decades, by Gus Clemens, special to the Standard Times, published July 19th. The past 40 years have been a roller coaster for Chardonnay, the most popular wine in the United States. As baby boomers came of wine drinking age in the 1970s and 1980s, consumption of Chardonnay soared. Growers planted everywhere possible and produced as much as possible, which does not do Chardonnay flavors any favors. In the winery, makers poured grapes into hard squeeze presses to extract as much juice as possible, aimed for high alcohol, then attempted to cover up flaws with malolactic fermentation and cords of oak. Boomers bought it until their palates matured. Then came the ABC, anything but Chardonnay, revolt. Fortunately, there were makers who knew how exquisite Chardonnay can be and knew how to make it. As boomers moved up financially, there was a market for their superior product. By the 21st century, Chardonnay, especially in California, was embarked upon a golden age for the gold-colored liquid. Makers took inspiration from Burgundy, Chardonnay's lodestar. Vines were planted in cool climate vineyards. Pruning focused on growing a few excellent bunches per plant rather than bunches of bunches. Great wines are made in the vineyard, not the winery, became the mantra. Grapes were picked at the peak balance of ripeness and acidity and harvested in the cool of the night and early morning to preserve those qualities. Grapes were lovingly treated. Individual berries were inspected, followed by gentle pressing. Skin contact was held to a minimum to reduce tannins. Fermentation occurred in temperature-controlled stainless steel, maybe in concrete eggs or oak barrels, or all three, so discerning makers could blend. High alcohol was avoided to make the wine more food-friendly. Malolactic? Maybe. Overdone oak? No. Often wines were segregated into their single vineyards of origin to be bottled and labeled. The goal was to allow grapes to reflect soil rather than flagrantly flaunt fruit aromas and flavors. The result is opulent, complex, refined, hedonistic pours. Chardonnay has come a long way, baby, from its ABC days. Tasting notes. Siduri Chardonnay, Willamette Valley 2019. The leading adjective to describe it is subtle. The fruit, as expected from Siduri's stable of quality grape growers, is excellent. $25 to $30. The Millkeeper Chardonnay, Napa Valley. Simply delightful and delightfully simple. $28. Etore Wine Chardonnay Zero, Mendocino, 2018. Pure expression of Mendocino Chardonnay, $32 to $42. Last round. My dog used to chase people on a bike. It got so bad, I had to take his bike away. Wine time. Email wine at cwadv.com. Newsletter gusclemens.substack.com. Website GusClemensWine.com. Facebook, Gus Clemens on Wine. Twitter, at Gus Clemens. And now here's our column from Allison Watkins. Despite the heat, summer is actually a good time to plant many vegetables and flowers. Published July 15th. It's tough to write about landscaping and gardening when it's so discouragingly hot and dry. But gardeners are eternal optimists and know that better conditions are always around the corner. Fall is still a few months away, but it's the best time of year for many vegetables and flowers. And now is the time to start planning and planting for a bountiful fall season. When they start popping up in nurseries and garden centers, plant fall perennials and annual color such as Autumn Joy Sedum, Autumn Sage, Fall Aster, Marigold, Zinna, etc. Prepare the soil with compost. Install drip irrigation, but water by hand for the first few weeks, and apply a thick layer of wood mulch, 3 to 4 inches deep, to help the plants establish well through the heat and grow strong roots for beautiful fall blossoms. Believe it or not, now is the prime time to plant tomatoes. July and August is a great time of year to plant fresh new tomato transplants for fall production. Other warm season vegetables, such as eggplant, cucumber, okra, peppers, and squash, can also be planted in late summer for a fall crop before it freezes in November. Tomatoes prefer cool weather and have trouble setting fruit when it's over 90 degrees. The larger the variety, the harder it is to get tomatoes when it's hot. Small cherry tomatoes can usually produce well all summer, but fertilization and fruit production in larger varieties slows down in late spring and stops altogether in the summer. Many spring-planted plants start to get stressed from pests like spider mites in the summer, so if your plants aren't looking healthy, consider replacing them with new transplants. Fall is a wonderful time of year to grow vegetables in West Texas. Choose large, healthy plants and encourage them to put on as much growth as possible in their first few months by irrigating steadily and fertilizing with nitrogen, but give them some time to establish before fertilizing. Nitrogen fertilizers can easily scorch or damage brand new transplants. Keep a close eye on water needs. Apply mulch and provide some shade in the afternoon for the first few weeks until they establish strong roots. For those that have tomatoes producing fruit but are struggling with birds, raccoons, etc., getting to them first, harvest as soon as they are full size, and start to develop some color. Research shows that tomatoes can be harvested fairly green with just a bit of pink or red color, and will fully ripen on the counter in the kitchen with no loss of flavor, quality, or nutrients. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.